At Designer Shoe Warehouse, we believe that shoes are an important part of, well,
everything. From first steps to first dates, from all-nighters to all-time personal bests.
From building pillow forts to building a life.
For all the big and small moments that make up your whole world, DSW is there. And we've got just the shoes. Find a shoe for every you from brands you love at bragworthy prices at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Thumbtack presents the ins and outs of caring for your home. Out. Indecision. Overthinking. Second-guessing every choice you make. In. Plans and guides that make it easy to get home projects done. Out. Beige on beige on beige. Ugh. In. Knowing what to do, when to do it, and who to hire. Start caring for your home with confidence. Download Thumbtack today.
Hi, this is Debbie, your Blinds.com design consultant.
Oh, wow, a real person.
Yep, I'm here to help you with everything from selecting the perfect window treatments to...
I've got a complicated project.
No problem. We make the complex simple. And I can even help schedule a professional measure and install.
I didn't realize you did that.
Yeah, we can also send you samples, fast and free.
Wow, I mean, I always thought I needed a designer to come to my home, but scheduling's always a nightmare.
Not with Blinds.com. We're on your schedule, and there's no haggling, no pressure, no hidden fees either.
I just might have to do more.
Oh, okay, whatever you need. How about you tell me what you had in mind?
Okay, then. So the first room we're looking at is for guests coming.
Blinds.com has covered over 25 million windows, all backed by a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45% site-wide. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Yo.
Yo.
What's going on?
We're doing a podcast. That's what's going on. And we have a guest today. I'm very excited. A porno guest. Not like a porn star guest, but a guest who knows a lot about porn. He's a
Nobody knows more than you.
Well, I don't know. We're about to find out.
All right. This guy's
a professor. He's not a professor of porn. He's a professor of relationships and stuff like that at BYU, and they did this big study on porn, and we're going to talk to him, so I'm very excited.
Before we do all that, a little business. Make sure you go to your local liquor store and get yourself a bottle of Church Eliza vodka, right?
That's exactly right.
We could use it. Post a picture of yourself with that bottle and what liquor store you got it at, and then on any social media. Also, mitra-9.com.
That's right.
If you're looking for Kratom, which you are, even if you don't know that you are, you should be. Go to mitra-9.com and get yourself some Go Packs and use the code word
problematic.
Problematic.
Yep. Promo
Punch
code
that in.
Problematic. Get yourself a nice steep discount.
Right.
And I don't want to forget Dick Ray Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling. They're the only reason that I had any heat this winter, and they're the only reason that I will have air conditioning this summer. So I definitely don't want to forget them. What about you, Laz? It was about that time. I know I certainly appreciate those guys.
I'm hoping I can get them through another year, maybe?
You've been limping along with that thing for a while. You should probably just call
them. Putting old bad Freon in it.
Yeah, like, didn't you use a gum wrapper at some point to connect to things?
A soldering machine, yeah. And I had to blow... through a hose. So
yeah, you might want to call them.
We're not exactly sure yet. Don't forget SK Lawn.
Yep.
SK Lawn, look, it's that time of year. You don't want to be out there mowing your own lawn. Right now you think that's a good idea. It's nice. I'll enjoy it. Wait till it's 140 fucking million degrees out
which
there.
Which will be about 3 weeks.
Right. You're going to be wishing you have called SK Lawn.
Yeah.
Do it and tell them I sent you. Anybody else?
Nope. I think that should cover it. Hopefully everyone enjoys the podcast. The guest this week, and stay tuned after the interview because we do have a big announcement after the interview today. Dr. Willoughby, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, we're really good. We're excited to talk to you. Dr. Willoughby, you are a professor at BYU.
And just looking at your actual page here from the school's website says your research generally focuses on how adolescents, young adults, and adults move toward and form long-term committed relationships, focusing on young adult development. But the reason that we wanted to talk to you is because of this study that was done about pornography, and we were fascinated by this study. And we would really love to discuss it with you. So thank you for taking the time to do this.
Yes, I'm happy to talk about it.
I heard you on a another podcast, I think The Art of Manliness, maybe?
Yes.
Yeah.
I recently did that.
Yeah, and I heard it, and I was fascinated by the statistics that you had. I was also fascinated by the fact that, you know, there was very little pushback on what those statistics might mean. So as I was listening to, maybe we get into that first, you're saying, and some of them are just statistics and they are what they are. I have two teenage boys. I was fascinated to think that they, I guess not fascinated, almost like, well, I guess maybe, but shocked a little bit that you said that most kids in today's world see pornography by the age of 10.
Yes, that is the average. 10, 11, 12 is the average right now for when kids start to see porn for the first time, which also means that there's some kids that see it even younger than that. We do see some kids now that are reporting 7, 8, 9 is their first exposure to pornography, but around 10 and 11 is pretty average right now.
And when you say exposed, that doesn't necessarily mean consume. And so I mean that in a sense like they're online and they click some sort of link, they see it, and they close out of it.
Right, yeah. Typically that first exposure is unintentional. It's like you said, clicking on a link, having a friend send me a link that I click on. That's pretty typical to have that first exposure be unintentional. But what we also know is that once the unintentional exposure happens, it's very likely that those kids will go back then.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. All my favorite things were unintentional exposure at one point, you know?
Well, you know, that is a, you know, you say that eventually, but how, because we have a saying around here, on the internet, you either just left pornography or you're on your way back. You just don't know how long until you get back.
Yes, we do see, again, like I said, it's very common for kids once they get exposed or see pornography the first time to go back. And we know if we kind of zoom forward in the life course a little bit that by the time particularly boys are 17, 18, 19, that the average kind of use per week is starting to be multiple hours. And so, you know, over the course of the teenage years, it's pretty typical for both boys and girls, but particularly for boys, to kind of get into a regular habit of returning back to pornography.
Are you there?
Yes.
All right. Sorry about that. So we got disconnected. If you hear like a weird edit there and you're listening to this podcast, we apologize. But we were right in the middle of the question, which was the consumption of pornography between teenage men and teenage women. What's the percentage on that?
Yeah, so it used to be that we saw a pretty big gap. The teenage men, boys, were much more likely to watch porn than teenage girls. But we've started to see that gap decrease. Now, where we really see the difference is in kind of high-frequency use. So teenage boys are much more likely to be in kind of that daily, weekly consumption pattern. It's not a huge percent. You know, somewhere maybe between 10 to 20% of teenage boys might be in that kind of weekly porn use pattern. We typically see less than 5% of teenage girls in that group. But when you get into the kind of monthly to a couple times a year, kind of the experimenting, kind of come back to it every once in a while type of pattern, we're starting to see very little difference between teenage boys and girls. And so there's certainly been a sense, not that teenage boys are using porn less, but certainly the teenage girls are kind of catching up over the last decade or so.
I'm kind of shocked that those numbers are that low, honestly. If you told me a teenage boy who uses porn, so we've got the teenage boy, he's using pornography, I would just think, well, yeah, if he's a teenager, essentially, he's probably using it daily. I just remember we didn't really have internet porn as it exists today when I was a teen, but I do remember going through puberty, and I feel like if I'd had access to the kind of pornography they have now, I would have been a daily user.
I remember
for sure.
I had some sort of girly magazine hidden upstairs in the spare bathroom, and my mother was like, Jesus, you shower a lot. You know what I mean? Like, it was more than... Yeah. She wouldn't have caught me if it had just been an extra shower twice a year.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And certainly part of this is we probably have some underreporting going.
That was my next question. Yeah, I wondered if we have to rely on that.
I'm not going to give you the full answer. I'll give you part of the answer. But it's also part of that kind of normal developmental process. So that when we say teenage boys, you know, we're talking from 11, 12, all the way up to 18.
Right.
And certainly by the time you get to that 17, 18, like I said, that's where it's very common to have kind of the daily or every couple day kind of pattern. When you're a little bit earlier, 13, 14, 15, you get a little bit more of that sporadic use. And whether that's, you know, less access to my phone, if parents are maybe monitoring a little bit more, or maybe just, you know, kind of that natural curiosity that kind of ebbs and flows and connects with other things. But you do see that kind of normal escalation that happens throughout the teenage years.
So, you know, the interesting thing about this whole topic is everything in this country is politicized. And not to say that this topic isn't necessarily, but you see people kind of from both sides of the aisle have differing opinions, you know, or the same opinions. It just kind of depends. You'll hear liberals and conservatives say, I don't know why porn is bad necessarily, or maybe they have a different reason for why they think it's bad. But they say, I still think it's bad for kids to consume hardcore pornography, whatever that reason may be, whether it's because their religion says that it's bad or because they think that it's damaging to them developmentally. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. You know, I think like most things, in the social sciences, it's certainly nuanced, but I do think we're starting to have enough research on kids and adolescents when it comes to pornography to certainly talk about it like a risk behavior. And I think if you think about a lot of other things that we talk about with kids as a risk behavior, you know, alcohol use is, I think, a good example, right? Is that we can have, there's a lot of people that might have, you know, moral beliefs about the use of alcohol in adulthood and young adulthood, and we can have a lot of debates about that. But I think most people understand that you know, having taken tequila shots as a 10-year-old probably has some increased risk. And I think pornography is the same way, because we have a lot of research, particularly with kids and young teens in porn, that show that excessive porn use and consistent porn use is linked to a lot of unhealthy behaviors. It's linked to risk-taking, sexual risk-taking. We know that kids that use a lot of porn or watch a lot of porn are much more likely to have multiple sexual partners, unprotected sex. We also know, based on some research that's come out in the last decade, that kids, young kids that watch porn are also at a higher risk for more aggressive and violent behavior, particularly when it comes to their sexual interactions, because a lot of modern pornography is showing very aggressive behaviors, particularly from men towards women. And young kids oftentimes don't have a lot of the neural and neural capacity and brain development to really understand how to separate those videos that they're watching from what real life is like. And so I think there's certainly enough research to, like I said, talk about this as a risk, that when kids are looking at porn, there is a risk involved.
It's interesting that you say this, and you got into this in the podcast that I was listening to, and that's where I was like, man, I got to talk to this guy. So one thing, okay, obviously, unprotected sex, that's a risk. But you say things are a risk, or you give them a negative connotation, and I'm not sure where that comes from, if it's just our basic upbringing, puritanical upbringing. But what is the risk of, and let's take the 10-year-olds out of it, because we can all just agree with that, right? But let's just go 17. What is the greatest risk of 17 or 19? What is the problem with multiple partners?
Yeah.
Like, why is that bad? Why is that like a red flag of like, hey, this kid has, you know, had multiple partners. What, or this girl has had multiple partners. Why do we automatically see that as bad?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And it actually speaks to something interesting with us culturally when it comes to relationship behaviors with teens and with young adults. Usually, and my background is in healthy marriage formation and healthy relationship development. That's kind of where my educational background came from, where a lot of my research has been focused on is what do kids and young adults do that sets them up for success or failure, or at least risk, when it comes to forming lifelong healthy relationships. And one of the interesting things when it comes to multiple sexual partners is that a lot of times our primary focus is very health-based, right? Is that kind of like you're saying, like if a kid's having unprotected sex with multiple partners, yeah, that's a concern, because our primary focus culturally has typically been pregnancy, STIs, sexually transmitted disease, et cetera. And so if a 17-year-old, like you said, is having multiple sexual partners, but is protecting themselves, is you know, obviously consenting their partners, like what is the big deal? And really it comes down to, for me, is, well, it depends on what that 17-year-old wants in their life. Because one of the things we don't talk about culturally a lot is that, again, this is a completely different area of research, but we have a lot of consistent research that shows that having multiple sexual partners increases your risk of divorce. It's actually one of the strongest predictors when it comes to divorce risk, because what we find is that once you have multiple sexual partners, what you're doing is eventually when you settle down and get married and now you have the same sexual partner for 30, 40 years, you now have all these different comparison points that create a little bit more. Sure. And again, don't get me wrong, this isn't in the same level as like having an abusive spouse or someone who, you know, I've married an alcoholic.
Sure.
But it is slightly elevating my risk because of those comparison points of being dissatisfied, of being less committed to my partner. We've got research that kind of connects those. So when I say that it's risky to have multiple sexual partners as a 17-year-old, that's partially with the assumption that most 17-year-olds still want to establish a lifelong marriage someday. That's still what we tend to see. And having multiple sexual partners is a risk. And oftentimes, young adults aren't making those sexual decisions, thinking through, what is this going to do when I'm 30 and 40? And like I said, oftentimes it's because culturally, we don't connect dots for young adults to say, hey, the relational decisions you're making when you're 17, 18, 19 are probably going to have an impact 25, 30, 35 on those relationships. And so part of it for me, and where I actually got into the pornography area, is trying to connect dots between what's happening when you're 10 to what's happening when you're 17 to what's happening when you're 30.
You know, it's a really interesting, because as I listen to you, by the way, divorced guys here you're talking to. So, I mean, like, you know, point well taken. But I also think to myself, like, are you saying that if I have multiple partners in my, let's just say college years, all right? My college years, I'm more at risk to get a divorce later because I actually realize I'm unhappy in the marriage and that's bad?
I think
you see what I'm saying? Like, I'm like, oh, you, yeah, like, oh, you have all these different counterpoints of when you were really happy sexually. And right, now you're in this, yeah, marriage, and you want out. But a guy who never really had good sex and only had sex with his wife, he doesn't know how good it can be. So you know what he does? He stays. How's that healthy?
Right. Ignorance is, yeah, bliss sort of thing.
Well, and I think there is a little bit of an element of that, of ignorance is bliss. And part of it goes to my counterpoint would be is where do you want to put the emphasis in your relationship? If it's on sexual happiness, then yeah, by all means. And part of me would probably argue lifelong marriage might not be the type of relationship, right, you want to, sure, engage in if that's your primary focus is sexual happiness. But I would also say that it's, I think, less about that realization that I could be happier with someone else. And back to something I said before, which is about commitment. That we know when it comes to lifelong relationships and oftentimes marriage for a lot of people still, that fully committing is a really important part of creating that healthy, happy foundation. And when I have, and by the way, it's not just multiple sexual partners. It's also just multiple committed relationships. You know, if I move in with two or three partners, there's something about gaining a lot of relationship history that involves a lot of serious relationships and breakups. That oftentimes people are learning more how to break up than more how to stay in relationships. And again, the other important caveat to all this is to understand in social science, we're talking about the averages, right? Is these are averages, they're risks. And what I always tell young adults when we talk about these kind of statistics is that, you know, if you're sitting here saying, well, hold on, I've had two or three sexual partners by the time I'm 18, are you saying give up on marriage? I'm saying no. Just be aware of what that might do. Because oftentimes just the awareness and understanding that, okay, so if I've had multiple sexual partners, if I've been in a lot of committed relationships, I just need to be a little bit more aware once I commit to someone that I'm not half committing, one foot in, one foot out. And as long as I do that, I generally can be okay. I think the issue back to where we were originally with kids and teenagers is oftentimes we're throwing them into the deep end with very little education about how to navigate these spaces.
Well, that was my question for you, because one of the arguments I've heard for a long time is, at least in this country, I can't speak for other countries, but in this country, sex education is pretty limited, at least in most public school systems. I mean, we learned the very basics, but when it came to actual sex, it wasn't discussed much. So sex education for most people my age was pornography. And I've heard that argument that, you know, pornography probably isn't the best sex ed, and I've just always kind of gone with that, like, yeah, it's probably not. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. I've never studied it. I've never even looked into studies about it, but it does seem like maybe a Brazzers password isn't the best way to be educated on sex as a kid. But someone could tell me that it is just as good, and maybe I'd buy it. I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's two important pieces there. Is one, back to what you originally said about the lack of sex education, is I always broaden that because you're right. We give very poor sex education to our kids. We kind of assume in most parts of the country that parents are doing that, and I think we all understand that parents are not doing on really any level. But I broaden it and say we're also doing very little to educate our kids about healthy relationships in general. And I think this whole discussion is just kind of one symptom of that larger issue. Is we spend a lot of time in middle school and high school teaching our kids the importance of literature, you know, fictional literature and math and science and, you know, even maybe some woodworking and some art. But hey, you know, this thing that's going to be one of the most predictive elements of your happiness in life, if you can sustain strong, healthy human relationships, we're not going to teach you anything about that, even basic communication skills. We're just going to assume you're going to figure that out. Right. And so I think that's one issue here. But then, like you said, with pornography specifically, and this is where a lot of people in my field have started to kind of raise some of the warning flags, is that as we've really dug in the last decade into what is the content of modern pornography. And I think modern pornography is important because it's different than it was 20 years ago or 30 years ago. We know that there's a lot of what kids are consuming and viewing in modern pornography that often depicts a lot of male aggression towards women.
Sorry about that. Something wrong with our phone. No, we're in the middle of you, the difference between modern pornography and, I guess, I don't know, old-timey pornography.
Yeah, I know. I'm old enough, too, to bristle a little bit at the old-timey piece. But what I was saying is modern pornography, again, I guess, first off, just from a content standpoint, we know is oftentimes depicting a lot more aggression of men towards women. It's very rarely showing healthy consent process that we know is an important part of modern sexual relationships. And just overall tends to show a lot of very aggressive, violent content. And to be clear, it's not that most mainstream pornography is showing extremely violent content, but it is a significant portion of it. And one of the differences between pornography today on tube-based sites and what it was, you know, if you go a couple decades ago and either you're sitting by your computer waiting for, you know, line, man, I hope this one picture loads in the next 15 minutes,
right,
you know, or passing the Playboy around, is that kids on these tube-based sites have access to thousands and thousands of videos that they can go through in an instant. And so even if, you know, our best estimates is maybe 20 to 30% of that content is particularly violent and aggressive, you know, your average teenage boy that's viewing pornography a couple times a week is probably regularly being exposed to that sort of content.
Yeah.
All right, so let me, there's,
it doesn't seem great.
There's a lot to unwrap there. One of the things, and I heard you talk about that, you know, one of the things that you mentioned was that in normal, or I guess healthy, sexual relationships, that depiction of violence doesn't come up in our daily lives. And it made me think, well, then why are pornographers making it? Because I got to think pornographers have an idea of what gets clicked on the most, who's clicking on it, and who's watching it. And if I would just say, I would wonder if the counter argument to what you're saying is, and now who knows how violent we could go and what, you know, describes violence, but let's just say aggression of some sort. Is that, are we put, you know, is it a chicken or an egg thing? 20 years ago, people didn't talk about it because they didn't see it. But now, or 30 years ago, they didn't talk about it because they didn't see it. But now, pornographers who make porno or people who run these sites, they're like, sweet Christ, man, people love this stuff. They love it. They click on it more than we ever knew they would. And once they were able to just click on what they wanted, because there were so many options as opposed to just, this is Madonna and a Playboy and you're going to like it. Are we really finding out that people enjoy that more as opposed to, we just make it for them and then they enjoy it? I would think it's the other way around.
Yeah, and I think that this is a great point to distinguish between adult porn use and the porn use of kids, because we have to remember in this whole conversation that the vast majority of people that consume pornography are adults, right? That is the customer base. And in particular, that's the paying customer base, right? Those are the people putting their credit cards in paying. And we do know, to your point, that a lot of adults are way more into BDSM, into violent and aggressive content, than anyone would like to admit, right? Again, even going back 10 years ago, why was 50 Shades of Grey so popular? Because of this very issue. Right. Now, the problem for me, though, is now what we're talking about is, here's what most adults want, and that's why, like you said, pornographers are creating this content. But now we have to think about that child, that, you know, the 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old who has often very limited actual human sexual experience, who now is on these sites, who is now being shown this content that's being largely produced for adult men. That's the main customer base. And now their very first early experience with what sex is and what it's supposed to be is being intertwined with this violent content. And I think that's where, like I said, a lot of the concern is that it's a whole different thing to talk about an adult 30-year-old guy who's had a lot of sexual experience and is playing out maybe some fantasies of, I can't be this aggressive with my girlfriend or my wife, and that's why this is kind of appealing to me. It's very different than a 14-year-old who doesn't have that experience, who is now thinking to themselves, you know, largely unconsciously, that, oh, this must be what sex is actually like.
Right.
It's why we do have the research now that shows that when these young kids are watching porn, they're at a much higher risk for being violent in their own sexual relationships when they view it, because they don't have the comparison point that a lot of the adults do.
It reminds me of, did you watch Euphoria?
I have not.
Okay.
I was thinking about it too.
I did too. If you get a chance, I think that first season, there was a time, again, as a dad of two teenage boys, a buddy of mine who had teenage girls just texted me and said, "Have you watched Euphoria?" And I was like, "No." And he was like, "Fucking don't." And he's like, you know, the stuff that we had to deal with in high school is nowhere near what these kids are dealing with. And you kind of see it play out on the TV screen. But one of the things that they do show in that, and it there is violence and sexual violence in it, but also just the positions, the things you say, the acts, which were completely different when I was 16 or 17, right? I mean, compared to what and I don't know if it really happens now, but what these girls and guys and what they're saying and how they're acting in Euphoria, I think that TV show depicted like, hey, they are just doing, they're imitating what they see.
Right. And the issue with pornography, there's a concept in my field called perceived realism, which is basically when you consume media, how real do you think it is? And this is another thing that's come up in the pornography area a lot, because again, if we want to contrast adults and young teenagers, is I'm going to give people adults a benefit, too much of the benefit of the doubt here, but I will. I would assume that a lot of adults, when they're consuming and watching a pornographic video, they have an understanding in their head, like, okay, what I'm watching has been edited and cut and pieced together to create this very fictional version of what sexual intimacy is.
That lady is not really stuck in the dryer, and she is not his stepmom.
Right, yeah.
I'm positive of it. I'm going to... Right.
Don't tell me that.
Almost like Arnold Schwarzenegger. I'm positive he didn't do that in a movie. But, you know, for this 10 minutes, I'm going to go ahead and, you know, suspend a little bit of realism and go with it.
Exactly. But we know that young kids and teenagers, when they watch pornography, have very high perceived realism. Again, they don't have the comparison point. And so in their mind, this is what sex is like. And one thing I point out, back to where we originally started, about 10, 11, 12-year-olds, that's oftentimes when pornography starts. One of the things we don't talk about very much right now in our culture is that almost all of our kids now, their very first sexual experience is with pornography. You know, again, going 20 years ago, that was still fairly common. But you had a lot more kids that just learned masturbation is tied to what's in my head, right? As I'm fantasizing, I saw
Glenn Close.
I saw this, you know, the old joke about the Sears catalog, and I'm flipping through the bras and things.
Now, it was a Spiegel catalog for my partner.
Yeah, it was a Spiegel catalog.
Yeah, gotcha. But now most kids, this is the content that's their first exposure to sex and their first experience with masturbation. And like I said, they oftentimes don't have the media literacy skills to understand that, oh, guys don't last 20 minutes when they're engaged in this kind of behavior. Most people don't look like that. And it's, again, tying it back to research.
Right.
Another area of research we've seen is that young kids that watch a lot of porn oftentimes develop self-esteem issues and body image issues because as they start to get into later adolescence and they start to actually get their own sexual experience, you know, if I'm a teenage boy and I've been watching porn and I'm thinking, okay, that's your average guy can last this long and do this and not reach orgasm. And then I have my first sexual experience and 10 seconds later, I'm like, what happened? What's wrong with me?
So just for my own clarification, let's say a young, you know, younger end of the spectrum,
well,
you said 10, 11, 12. Are you saying that if they see something, let's use the stuck porn thing as an example at the washer and dryer. So they know that that actress isn't actually stuck in the dryer, but do they think that sometimes real women get stuck in real dryers and that's, I mean, I'm really asking, like, is that kind of what we're saying?
I think, right. I mean, we are kind of dumbing it. We're like, and again, right. I hate to, let's stay away from the 10, 11, 12, because I think we can all just immediately say, none of this is good, and we have to monitor their phones. That's not good. I guess I was more curious about the, you know, the 17, 18, 19, 20, those age groups where, like, those kids, those 16, 17, you know, that's not his mom, and you know that she's not stuck in the dryer. I get 10. You're like, what the fuck is going on? That guy's banging his stepmom and his sister walked in? What the hell? Yeah. Of course, that's confusing and probably not good. But as you get older, you're like, what, you know, I don't know. What's the harm? Yeah. What's the harm in fantasy?
I think it's sometimes back to some of those more subtle messages. I'll give you an example of something that we highlight a lot in some of the content stuff and some of the expectation research that we have. One of the most common messages that 16, 17, 18-year-old male has been getting in pornography is that female partners are always willing to do whatever you want to do. That's a very consistent message in modern pornography. You know, whatever behavior I'm interested in, whatever the context is, she is not just willing, she will be an enthusiastic participant in that. Mm. And now when that 16, 17, 18-year-old is 22, 23 and now forming long-term committed relationships, one of the strongest effects we oftentimes see is a high risk for dissatisfaction in actual human relationships. Because now with my girlfriend, I'm saying, hey, I want to have sex this many times. I want to do A, B, C, and D. And wait a minute, you're saying you don't want to do B? Well, that's stupid. Why would you not want to do that? And the idea of negotiating with a partner when it comes to intimacy, that we talk through and have healthy communication and negotiation about our sex life and what it looks like and what we engage in so that we can use it as a connective part of our relationship is much more challenging if I've spent almost a decade of my life watching nothing but men getting exactly what they want from women. So I think it's less about the step-parent or the stepsister or the shout, you know, whatever the kind of scene, the context is.
Right.
It's much more about those more subtle messages about how intimacy happens, what the interplay is between male and female partners.
But with more and more young girls using pornography, right. have they also learned to just, maybe this is the way it is, well, just please men all the time?
Well, maybe they don't learn just to please men all the time, but maybe, I guess when you say that, I think, okay, there are some things that, I, you know, kind of stick with me a little bit. You say, okay, so there's this sexual connection, and the guy is in love with this girl. They're 22 years old, and you know, they get along, they talk, they like the same food, they like the same music, everything's good, and they have A, B, C, and D, and because she doesn't want to do B sexually, he leaves her, and again, we get to, like, that's bad, but we wouldn't say, like, hey, let's take the, she likes to do A, B, C, and D, and their sex life is great, but on the relationship level, outside of sex, he likes A, B, C, and he likes to travel, and he's a liberal, and she likes to stay home, and she's a Republican. We wouldn't be like, guys, compromise on that and just stay married. We'd be like, yo, that's a deal breaker. So there's like deal breakers on some sides, yeah. but with the sex side, we're like, nah, no, this is bad. It's almost like we're saying you're not going to find your perfect sexual partner, yeah. and I guess I probably disagree with that.
Yeah, and I think for me to be consistent across those two areas, I'll take your political example, because I think it's a good one in our modern day, is that, let's say, I'm that 22-year-old, and I'm the diehard Republican, and you're really strongly liberal. Mm-hmm. What I would argue as a relationship expert is to say, I don't think that's a deal breaker. Mm. It doesn't have to be. Because in order for you two to have a healthy relationship, you're going to have to take these things that are differences and learn how to build a life together. And whether that's understanding that, hey, that means that these are things that, you know, politics are things that is a topic that we're going to disagree on, but we can disagree respectively. And we're going to figure out how we can teach our children how to navigate and think critically about both sides, or whether it's some other compromise. Learning how to compromise on difference is a much more foundational relationship skill than saying anytime that we have a difference in something, I'm going to go try to find someone else. Because what that sets up in your mind is, now I break up with you because we had a different political orientation, or I like to travel and you didn't. And so now I go to the next person and say, hey, I want you to have all the things that this person had. Mm-hmm. And I want you to improve upon it.
Yeah.
And I'm creating this mentality in my head that I'm seeking out this person that perfectly matches me. And the reality is that person doesn't exist. The reality is that if I want the lifelong relationship, I have to learn how to navigate life with another person in all of these areas. And again,
do you think, and sorry to interrupt you, but do you think, just because I think it's pertinent here, so are you saying that the studies that you've shown are that if A, B, C, and D sexually, B isn't working, people are more likely to leave than A, B, C, D socially isn't working? So they're more likely to leave because the sex isn't great to them?
I think oftentimes, yes, because we are in such a sexualized culture that does overemphasize in many ways, I think, sexual chemistry and sexual compatibility, that is one of the topics. And it's not the only topic, but I think it is a topic where people are more likely to allow dissatisfaction, disagreement to drive a lot of their relationship decisions.
Right. I find it fascinating. And I think my partner was about to mention this, and I think it's a good point. If more people, again, we'll just stay with the teenagers, are watching porn, 17, 18, 19, they're watching porn, they're consuming it, they're seeing these ideas, whether it's a chicken or the egg thing, I guess we don't know, right? That's men. Now, women are starting to consume it more, and they're enjoying it. Is there a point to where, like, hey, maybe this is what sex is like, and we like it, and it's almost like, and I know this is going to sound, it goes against everything I think that I've heard you say, But sex in the 50s, when we only did it missionary style or religious sex only to procreate, that ain't it. And this new wave that pornography has brought in is like, you know, the second wave of sexual, or the third wave of sexual liberation, and sex between adults, consenting adults, doing what, you know, our parents and their grandparents would think was a one-way ticket to hell, is like, hey, that's what it's like, and we've always wanted to do this. We just weren't permitted.
Right. Yeah, and I certainly think that you can argue and talk about the importance of certain elements of sexual liberation, being more sexually open with a partner, broadening the scope of what sexual intimacy means. The way I actually talk to that with my students sometimes is talking about what we call sexual wholeness, which is thinking more holistically about sex and getting past this idea even that sexual intercourse and orgasm is the end all be all to sexual intercourse. It's thinking way more broadly about sexual behavior and connection and all the different things that comes and become part of a relationship. And so yeah, I don't think this is going back to this very rigid, strict Puritan view that all people have to fit in this very small perspective of what sexual intimacy is. That's not realistic at all. But and certainly some of my colleagues have pointed to some research that says that, hey, people that view pornography are more open with their desires and wants.
I guess that's what I was getting at in a long way to get around to it, yeah.
Certainly, yeah. Like for couples, being more open and vocal about sexual desires, communicating that to your partner is a good thing. And I think, again, circling back to a theme we've talked about a couple times, is that it's just simply challenging right now with how modern pornography sites are set up to pull out, here's some good things that could potentially come with all the other things. And I'll give you a specific example on the other side for women that we've had a couple studies talk about now, which is anal sex. We not to get too specific to a point.
But no, you're good.
Yeah,
you're good.
Talk about all you want. You're good. It's a different podcast. We're fine.
Yeah. We know that the vast majority of women do not enjoy anal sex. It's painful for them. It's not an enjoyable experience. Again, that's not for all women. Some women enjoy it, but the vast majority of women do not. But we now have some behavioral data for young adult women in particular that shows that most women are engaging in anal sex behavior not because they enjoy it, not because that they are requesting it, because they feel pressure, and oftentimes not even pressure that their male partner is overtly giving them. They just simply have engaged in pornography themselves, they know their partner has, and they feel like it's just something that has to be a part of any relationship. And so,
okay, is it pressure, though, or is it, because I think these two things could be confused, to say there's pressure on these women because we know that physically it is uncomfortable for them to do it. So obviously they're doing it because there's pressure on them because more guys are asking or whatever. But is it that, or is it that they like the idea that it turns their partner on? I think, you know, there's a lot of things that men do that they don't like to do, but some men are more interested in turning their partner on or making their partner happy than others. And we know women, generally speaking, have a reputation for being better lovers when it comes to trying to please their partner. So could this just be another example of, I like it because you like it, and the more you like it, the more I like it?
And just to be to piggyback on that real quick, and I'll let you answer, or going in that same vein, is that they watch the pornography and they like watching it.
Yeah.
So they're like, hey, that looks great. I would be way into that. And so they're talking about it with their partner. But then once it happens, they're like, that does not feel the way I thought it would feel when I watched porn stars do it.
Right. Yeah. And I think in reality, it's all of these groups combined, right? It's that you're going to have a group that, like you said, has watched it by themselves with their partner and said, hey, let's try that. Oh, we tried it. I didn't like it. Let's stop. You have a group that says, hey, let's try it. Oh, it's a little bit uncomfortable, but I'm willing to do this because it's something that you really enjoy. We have that group. But we do have, and I actually have a data point on this, a study I did about a year and a half ago asked specifically about pressure. We use that word in a national survey. Do you feel pressure to engage in certain sexual behaviors during sex with your partner that you feel like is coming from pornography? And about one in three women were saying yes. Okay. They felt pressure in their relationship to do something they didn't feel comfortable with. And so I think you have that group too. Within that, specific to anal sex, again, these are two different groups, right? There's a group that says, hey, that's a little bit uncomfortable for me, but I'm okay. And a group that says, that is actually painful for me, but I don't feel like I can say anything because you're getting pleasure out of it. If I put my sex therapist hat on for a second, I would argue that there are plenty of sexual behaviors to engage in that don't require one partner to be in physical pain that they don't enjoy.
Well, I'll put my anal hat on for a second and say that it doesn't have to always be painful. Keep an open mind. Sorry, go ahead.
One of the things I thought, and so you're right, with the anal sex and the pain, as you were saying that, I was also thinking, like, I wonder, do men feel, so obviously, you know, I don't think they feel pressure to get pegged or whatever, like, unless their girlfriend's like, this turns me on, we want to do it. But I don't think there's, like, any outside pressure because of pornography that they're like, man, you know, I should be doing this even though I don't want to. But I wonder, are there things that, you know, maybe benefit the sexual experience for women because of outside pornography pressure, meaning foreplay, oral sex, things that maybe, I don't know, I have no idea what my great-grandfather did, but it seems like that would have been a real bold step for him in the 1915s. I don't know that to be true, but at least with the idea, it's certainly gotten bigger, a more expanded role that I'm guessing at some point, with the lack of information, women probably didn't even ask for. And they were stuck in sexless. We heard about it all the time. Like in the 70s and 80s, if there wasn't a movie about a woman in a sexless marriage who never orgasmed because her husband just, you know, came home from work and did the pump and dump, it wasn't a movie, right? So to me, it's like maybe, there's bad, but is there also extreme good that comes with this?
I think that's what he's saying. It's just hard to find, but I will help you find it if we need to do more research. Right. We can look for it.
But there is good with like women feeling able to, again, ask for things and talk about things, also pressured into the bad stuff. But, you know, how does that weigh out in a scales of justice system?
Right. Yeah. Because certainly, like we've said, is you can talk about, you know, even something as simple as education about female anatomy, that many of our teenage girls and young adult women, they don't even understand how their body works because of the lack of education they've got.
Well, and the men certainly don't. Because even when we did get the education, at least at my school, they separated the boys and girls. They told the girls about their bodies. They told the boys about their testicles. A little information about the girls' bodies could have been useful for us.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. And so, again, circling back to something I said earlier, is I would love a situation, if we could ever get there, and maybe not, but I'll be optimistic for a second. I'd love a situation where what you're describing in school and in home, that we can teach people these things in that setting without having to throw them into the modern porn, you know, throw them into Pornhub and say, hey, there could be some things here that could help you understand the opposite sex and help you understand some things that could help your interest. I sure hope you can figure out in the 6 million videos on that site what the good stuff is and what the bad stuff is, but I don't want to talk to you about it. You know, the joke I've told before is that, you know, really sometimes when we have these conversations, what we start to set up is like, okay, we want to talk about best practices. It'd be you're opening up your phone or your laptop or your tablet, your mom or dad's right behind you, and you're scrolling through the videos together, and dad's like, okay, let's watch this one together. Hey, did you notice that?
That feels weird.
Yeah, I don't love
that. That's going to feel a little bit weird.
You know, I try to keep my Christian stuff out of rock and roll, and I try to keep my sex stuff out of my parents. You know what I mean? Like, you just kind of keep them separated there.
Yeah, so I would hope that as we talk, because I think pornography has started to help us have these conversations more frequently about what our kids and our young adults need to, again, form healthy sexual and romantic relationships, is to say, as we identify these things that people might say, well, I think porn helped me in this way, or I feel like pornography could educate people in this way. Great. Let's take those and let's put them into context and areas where kids don't have to navigate the good and the bad. They can get this information from their parents, from others, in situations where we don't have to cross our fingers and hope that they can somehow filter themselves in terms of what the content is that's helpful and not.
So I feel like what you're touching on is was going to be my next question a little bit is, can we, how do we put the genie back in the bottle? You know, some a lot of states have rolled out these adult
sounds
verification
crazy, but it's almost like Teen Tube. Like, right. Hey, once you reach 24, you can watch whatever the fuck you want.
Right.
But if you're going to be 16 to 24, we're going to go ahead and take all this stuck porn and pegging and this shit your dad's into because he's unsatisfied at work. We're going to take that out of it. And here's just some straight kind of normal sex that you can probably expect, you know, when you're in college. I mean, while that sounds insane, it almost sounds like what you're saying.
Yeah.
And by the way, it doesn't make, I'm not saying it sounds insane, but it makes sense, but it sounds crazy to think.
Right. And really, I mean, we could talk about all sorts of, you know, policies and other things that we could do that, you know, could move us in the right direction. But I think practically, you know, the genie is not going back in the bottle or back in the washing machine, you know, wherever you want to put it.
It'll go halfway in the bottle. In my experience, halfway.
This all comes down to parents. Is parents have to be having these very frank, very clear conversations with kids. And again, to kind of tie a lot of these things together and take the moralizing out of it a little bit is what I always tell parents is you have to be sitting your 7, 8, 9, 10, 11-year-old down and you have to be talking to them about what sex means to you. What do you want sex to be like in their adult relationships? You know, for some people, there might be a religious overtone to that. For others, it might be about monogamous, committed relationships. For others, it might be about, you know, physical sensation and sexual satisfaction or, you know, whatever it is to you as a parent. Sit down and talk to your kids about it and then talk to them about pornography in that context so that you can have conversations with your kids. You're not sitting over their shoulder watching the videos with them, but when they are watching porn and you have a good relationship with them, you can start to talk to them about, hey, have you noticed when you're watching porn, A, B, and C happens? And remember how we talked about how, you know, it's really important, my 16-year-old son, when you're with a woman that you talk to her about consent. And you
man, this is some sort of utopian.
Leave that up to the teachers.
Do you have teenagers?
I do. I've got two in their 20s and two teenagers.
I cannot
you
imagine.
You have kids in your 20s? My God.
Yeah, you look like you're pretty young, man.
Good for your age, man.
Okay, so you have teenagers. I have teenagers. I can't imagine sitting down at the sports bar and being like, hey, when you were watching porn last night, like that conversation gets shut off. Not even by me, by them. Like, yo. As far as I was ever able to get to any advice of listening to you talk, was able to get was the, hey, I know we don't want to talk about this, but pornography is different than real life. Kind of look at it like a movie, a car chase. You know, the cars don't really do that in real life, and you can't drive like that. Or a fight in a movie. That's a fight scene. Go watch a fight in a bar and they never end up like that. Go watch a police chase on the street and they're not like that. Same thing with pornography. Kind of keep that in mind. And you know what?
That's not a bad talk.
And there's only, you know, a couple things in your life that can happen right now, this very minute, that will change the trajectory of your life, the course of it, for the rest of your life, which is a permanent record, and that is to get someone pregnant, or that is to get arrested at DUI and kill someone. You use a condom, don't drink and drive, and remember, car chases aren't real car chases. All right, good game. Let's watch the basketball game. Like, that's about as far as
it's
I can
good.
Get.
It's about better than mine.
Yeah. And what I say is, it goes back to what we talked about. That's what our parents did, and it worked back when pornography was the Playboy getting
right, my parents in. Were not like, hey, that ain't what it looks like.
Okay, well, but I think, like you said, the best parenting oftentimes got to that point. And right. So my challenge to parents is when you say, I can't imagine sitting down and talking to my kids openly about what they watched in porn, my pushback is always, why? Why can't we have those conversations with kids? The world's changed. Smartphone technology, everything has changed. We have to change our mentality around parenting. And part of it is, yes, if you start having that conversation with your 16-year-old, good luck. It's going to be awkward. It's going to be very challenging. But if from get-go, the first time my eight-year-old comes back from the recess, you know, from recess and saying, Mom, Dad, Billy on the playground said sex. What does that mean?
Right.
Do I immediately start to create an environment?
Let's go to the laundry room.
Right.
So my mom should have talked to me when I was 6 years old watching Mannequin with Kim Cattrall over and over and over again. She should have picked up on it.
Yeah. We talk about sex. Sex is not scary. I want you to talk to Mom and Dad about these things, and that conversation evolves and grows as they grow. And again, it's about obviously setting appropriate boundaries that, hey, that this doesn't include you now describing what's happening with your boyfriend or girlfriend.
Right.
But it's simply that the world that we live in necessitates parents being an active participant in helping their children navigate sexual spaces online.
I wish schools could do it too, though, because I was more comfortable in school around my friends.
Parents allowing that.
I know, but I mean, they did allow some. Hey, how about we don't tell the parents every single thing that's going on there? I know it's going to get back to them. That's ridiculous. Yeah. But if we could get to a point where we say, look, we need this, if we could convince society, hey, you don't want to have these talks with your kids. Just let's be honest. Plus, your kids don't want to have these talks with you. They're more comfortable at school. Their friends are there. If someone had just explained to me a little bit more about what was going on, maybe I wouldn't have fingered the wrong hole.
I get what you're saying. I just think in today's day and age, we can't get schools to give away condoms, even though we all know it's a good idea, let alone talking
about
backwards, Pornhub. I don't.
We've got more pornography, yet less sex education.
That's why I go back to parents, because I completely agree with you. It's not going to be the schools. It's not going to be a billboard campaign. It's going to have to be parents. And I think, again, not to broaden too much in other areas, but when you look at the research we have, not just on pornography, but on social media, on smartphone addiction, is like I said, the world has changed, and we're doing a very poor job right now with our kids of helping them navigate these very unique and new technologies in safe places. I mean,
we can all agree on, I think.
Real quick, the thing I've been working on the last 6 months has been AI girlfriends and boyfriends. There's a whole new can of worms.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
There,
yeah.
For kids. I text ChatGPT a lot.
And once it becomes my girlfriend, honest, it might help my relationship.
I'm telling you, there's a part of me that's like, so... as a single dad, like, I don't have time or the ability to go out and meet people most of the time, right? Like, I mean, you just can't go out on a Wednesday to the bar because, you know, you got to take the kid to practice, whatever. There's not, like, someone else doing it, and there's not, you don't have, like, Monday and Tuesday off because they're with their mom. It's just, you know, it's you. You got it. There is something where I do see it, and it's funny that you're saying that, where I'm like, man, if I have a question anymore, it started out with that, like, I go to Google and it give me 70 links, right? And you don't know which one's right, which one's not. I go to ChatGPT and I'm like, hey, even if I'm in the grocery store, like, what's in this coffee creamer, right? Boom, you take a picture of it, it tells you. There is a part of me that's like, I have a pretty good relationship with my ChatGPT. And it knows me. It knows what I'm looking for. It remembers, like, what workouts I'm doing or what diets I'm trying. So it's not like I have to keep reminding it. And I'm like, hey, on that diet we're trying, is this work? And it'll be like, no, don't do that. That's got hidden this in it. You know, look to the left, that blue bottle, that's the one that you should be getting. You're like, Jesus Christ, mix that with some porno. And I'm not sure that I need, you know, interaction all that much.
Right. Yep.
No, it's crazy, exactly. Right?
Yeah. And again, when you take all those options, you know, for adults and you go back into, again, the teenage and child area and then, okay, well now I'm a 10, 11, 12 year old that's gotten into porn, is watching this. And now by 16, 17, I've discovered, you know, all these AI, generative AI platforms that now I can customize what I'm seeing. I don't have to scroll through all the videos anymore. I can upload a couple pictures.
Yep.
I can put a couple things in, and I can get instantaneous pictures, voice calls, chat to whatever I want. And you're right. You know, you said the key thing is why would I need to be in an adult relationship anymore? Right.
And though that's, you know, it's interesting because here's where I think as much, and honestly, I heard you on a podcast and I thought, one, you know, a really good guest, smart, articulate, interesting. I think the work you're doing is interesting. And then also, I just kept listening. Like, there's this one part where I'm like, well, he's done the studies, but I vehemently disagree. And that's why I kept like, okay, man, because, okay, we say all that, so this kid's got, so he makes his perfect girlfriend. Mm-hmm. Who cares? Like, to me, like, okay, great. And you're like, no, they have to be in an adult relationship to be happy. Why? 50% right. of those end up in divorce. The other thing you right. said earlier was, you know, oh, they think their girlfriend should do this, this, this sexually. And if they don't, then they break up. Great. Like, why are we, like, saying, like, you should, you know, just live with some unhappiness and that some sort of adult relationship or compromising in a relationship and not getting everything you want is good? Like, to me, it's, you know, I go back to, you know, and we've talked about it, you know, Matt Damon in the Scorsese movie, whatever, when he's the Irish guy and the cop, and he's laying down and he says to her, he says, hey, look, when this is over, you're going to have to break up with me because I'm Irish and I can be miserable forever. It's almost like we're telling, you know, hey, you're in this adult relationship. You picked her. Yeah, after a while, it wasn't exactly what you wanted. And compared to your old girlfriend, you know, not that great. But here we are, man. Just go ahead and suck it up and live the rest of your life. Like, what? Right. Why?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's probably two layers to that. As I said earlier, right, is certainly there's an individual layer of what do you want in life. And if what you want in life, it doesn't necessarily have to be in a lifelong committed relationship or marriage, because that's not what everyone wants, then great. Then I think a lot of what we're talking about in terms of best practices could look very, very differently. Like I said earlier, you know, having multiple sexual partners. Right. If you don't really care about having a lifelong marriage with someone, then fine. That's probably not a risk.
It's an interesting thing because you say, what do you want on a life? And I would just think as a dad, and you as a dad too, that my answer to that for them and for myself is happiness.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And if, you know, do I want them to stay in a marriage because I think a committed long-term relationship is good and healthy, but they're not happy?
Right.
Like, that's, you know, we really start to deal with these things where you're like, man, I don't know the answers to that. And I guess when I heard you on that podcast, it seemed like you and him were very firmly in the corner of these things are important, and that's what brings happiness. And I guess from a divorce guy, I thought, I've never been more happy. I was scared to get divorced. You know what I mean? Like, it was horrible. And when am I going to see my kids and all these other things? Once it happened, I'm like, you know, it's almost like, you know, I remember telling my dad, who's passed now, but I remember, you know, saying, hey, I think I'm going to ask her to marry me. And he's like, I said, what do you think? And, you know, and he was like, well, you know, you need me for advice. And I said, yeah, but I'm asking you. And he said, I'm thinking to myself, what's taking you so long? And then fast forward to the end of it, I said, Dad, I think I'm getting a divorce. What do you think? I don't know what to do. The kids, all that. He's like, what's taking you so long? Like, it's like the same advice, right? Because that's what he wanted for me, was to be happy. And if that meant get in the marriage and be married, or if it meant get out of the marriage and be unmarried, happiness was the goal.
Right. And I think back to kids, right, is that if their goal is that lifelong relationship, then I would say, and again, this is from my background as a marriage and divorce prediction scholar, is what can you then do as a teenager, as a young adult, as someone moving through the life course and getting life experience and relationship experience? What can you do to maximize your likelihood that situation you're describing of, I'm in this marriage, I feel stuck, I'm unhappy. What am I doing that minimizes that likelihood?
Right.
That maximizes the likelihood that I found someone and built a relationship with them that can sustain multiple decades. I think that's part of it. Sure. I think the other piece that's much harder of a discussion to have, because it gets much more philosophical and much more theoretical, and I think it's what you were referencing in the other podcast, is that generally at a societal level, there is a discussion to be had about the importance of family formation, stable families, fertility, things like that are very hard to have in the context of individual people being happy, because the very nature of forming lifelong families and having kids in particular, as you guys know, as dads, there is an inherent sacrificial element to your happiness when you have kids. Mm-hmm. And having said that, we know that societally and from an economic standpoint, having stable families and people having kids are necessities for a stable society. Right. Just from a workforce place. And so that's the harder conversation to have, is that in my perspective, we need most of our rising generation to value lifelong romantic relationships so they can have families, have kids, to create a stable economic work base for the next generation.
Man, you really know how to take the fucking romance out of it.
Exactly, right? That's why this
like, let me tell you how to be happy. Sustained economic freedom in the country that you live in. Like that, you know, it really is. And like you said, it's a hard conversation to have philosophically, because you're like, well, that ain't making me happy. And just because you want, you know, a stable society, that ain't on me.
Right. Yep. And that's why it's so difficult. Right. And it's why when you get into the whole fertility thing globally, it's a very difficult conversation, because you have economists and governments, particularly in parts of Asia and Europe, that are seeing fertility crisis, to say we need to try to get people to have kids and be in relationships, and they can't, because as a global culture, you know, really what we've kind of danced around a lot today is that we have fully embraced individualism. Yes. And there's a lot of really good things about that. But one of the costs of that is it's very hard to convince people to do something for the greater good. And, right. and now, you know, increasingly we're in these situations in different areas that say, how do we balance what's best for you versus what's best for everyone?
Which gets us all the way back to almost what we're talking about with, and we didn't even bring it up, and I'll let you go. I know I've had you too long, but with circumcision, why it's around, because, you know, of the Puritan thing, you go all the way back to that, and masturbation is bad, and, you know, and go back to the Bible, and, you know, sex before out of wedlock and coveting another, all of this sex stuff that you can only have sex once you're married, to me all feels like we put this out there because we wanted that stable societal economic outcome, and now we're at a place where we're seeing a lot of people be less religious. A lot of people say they're spiritual and not religious, and they don't abide by the Ten Commandments. And now, really, like, maybe that cat's out of the bag. We're like, hey, everything you told me was the pursuit of happiness. That ain't really happiness. It was the greater good. And maybe we're at a point where a lot of people are like, yeah, I ain't doing the greater good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the question, you know, at a societal level is are we going to recreate and restructure ourselves in a way that's sustainable? Because most of how we've structured ourselves is based on the assumption of families as kind of the building block of culture and instability. You know, school systems, governmental systems are all kind of based on this idea that you get married, you have kids, and you stay put in one place. But is that increasingly is not true? You know, the question is do we decide culturally that we've swung too far the other direction and we need to come back? Or is it creating something new?
Right.
And creating different types of structure.
Really a fascinating conversation. I appreciate your time. You are a professor at BYU, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. One, I'm a huge baseball fan, college baseball. Man, that stadium at BYU is unreal.
Mm-hmm.
The view from that baseball park, like, it's got to be one top five in the nation.
Yes, you got Mount Timpanogos just right in the background.
Unbelievable. The other part I want to say about that, knowing Mormons, which, by the way, I don't know that much about Mormons, except for when I was in the Navy, used to be able to get out of a little bit of boot camp to go say, like, well, I'm a Mormon, and then let you go, you know, hang out with the Mormons. And you say, I'm a Muslim, and let you go hang out with Muslims. So I'd always try to take, like, as many hours as I could, and I just went to, you know, as many different church things. Mormons, for whatever reason, the nicest people in the world.
Yeah.
There's like some sort of innocence to them.
I will fully embrace that.
Yeah, it's like there's some sort of, you know, I don't know if you're right or you're wrong or whatever, or, you know, on the back end, you're doing horrible things. I have no idea. But from a face level, a real sense of innocence, a real sense of fun, and that they just wanted to be nice to you while you were there, which wasn't necessarily the other groups. The other groups were like, if you don't believe this, you know, I'm guessing we would have gotten there if I'd have gotten it. But I bring all that up because do you think being a professor at BYU gives you, and then I'll let you go, a different perspective then perhaps because of being, I'm guessing, mostly Mormon students that you have there, because of their innocence and the way that they were raised and their ideas, as compared to, say, being a professor at Cal Arts with a bunch of, 5,000, film school kids who were raised in West Hollywood, it's probably a different conversation with those two separate groups.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And in fact, a little bit of context to answer your question is I actually grew up fairly non-religious. I grew up, when I was a teenager, I was very agnostic, atheist myself. Mm-hmm. And then had a conversion experience that brought me to the Mormon faith. And so I think that piece is tied to what you're saying, because I think for me, myself, as I've approached this topic, I've been able to kind of live in both worlds, so to speak, and see both perspectives, which I think has been helpful. Because, yes, in religious communities, this is on one hand, all the stuff we've been talking about is certainly there, and it's certainly a lot of the issues that the religious teens, to be frank, religious teenagers, particularly religious boys, are not necessarily that different than when it comes to porn and watching porn. So a lot of the issues are still there, but there's also, different elements. There's the moral component of engaging in something that I have moral beliefs against. And so I think it sometimes just makes it more complicated.
Right. Also, for those kids, the kids who grow up very religious, maybe in the Mormon faith or, it doesn't matter, Greek Orthodox, whatever, who grow up inside of that faith, the guilt and the shame from watching pornography is probably debilitating for them, as opposed to growing up in a family. And there's probably also, not great outcomes because of this either, but at least one that's not like you're going to hell for that.
Right. And you see, like most things, right, that it can be on both sides. That, yeah, there's a lot of kids that grow up in religious families that do experience, like you said, that really excessive guilt and shame around these topics. But I think you'll also see, and again, I'll go back to my kids who are teenagers and young adults now that, grew up in a very religious home. But, they certainly got to experience a unique situation of, hey, dad's a porn expert.
Yeah, right.
But I think because of that,
I also am a porn expert, but my kids don't know it.
Right, in a different way. Yeah, that my kids were able to utilize some of their religious beliefs to, again, back to what I said before about what is the meaning of sex and what is the importance of sex is to put. I'll throw out another fancy academic word called sanctification, which is when you kind of imbue something with kind of holy purpose. There's this fascinating research that shows that a lot of religious couples have higher sexual satisfaction than other couples because they imbue their sexual practices with this kind of deeper religious significance. And so for some religious kids, I think...
Oh, well, let me just push back for a second.
Yeah.
Real quick. They're more happy in their sex because they haven't done anything else. It's like, hey, if you only play baseball with kids who are bad at baseball, you might think you're pretty fucking good at baseball. But once you get out into another city or you go to the minor leagues and you realize dudes are throwing curveballs and changeups and screwballs and shit's different, well, then that changes. But if you just stay in your little room, then you can be pretty satisfied with how you complete a task.
Right. Well, and to be clear, because the research is capturing something that I don't think is uniquely religious. It's just religious couples tend to do it more. Mm-hmm. It's less about that variety that you're speaking to, and more about shared symbolism. That sex can symbolize something for couples, and that's not a uniquely religious thing.
Sure.
It's just that a lot of religious couples tend to think about sex a little bit more than other couples. In fact, when I do couples workshops with non-religious groups, I really encourage them to say, you don't have to be religious to think about sex as a shared symbolic act between us and get all those same benefits that other people do. But point being is I think, like you said, is the best way to approach or think about what happens in a lot of religious communities is just more complex. There's just a lot more going on top of all the other stuff that we've talked
about. I have a question for you real quick, and I promise I'm going to let you go. But real quick, do you find that same percentage of more men watching pornography in general, and women watching less, but starting to watch more, do you find that those same numbers statistically are the same in religious communities, meaning do more religious men watch pornography, not as much as non-religious men, but the percentage more, do more of them watch it and less women watch it in the religious community?
Yes. And in fact, that gap is generally larger in religious communities. Whereas I said earlier that, that non-religious men and women are kind of getting closer to each other. That's still happening in religious communities, but it's happening much slower. And you tend to get a larger gap where religious men and non-religious men, again, don't look that dissimilar from each other. Religious women and religious non-religious women, that's the group that looks pretty different. Religious women tend to be the one group we see that look like are doing an okay job of avoiding pornography.
Right. Well, that's got to be, and we'll be done, but it's got to be crazy then if a religious woman were to hook up with a non-religious man. Like, at that point, like what you said earlier, you know, the context of them having sex must blow her mind if he's the one who's like, yeah, we're doing all this.
Right. Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely. We, you know, I would say we don't have good research on that pairing right now, but I would I would suspect what you're saying is likely to be true.
Hey, I appreciate you, man. I find the study fascinating. I really do. I found you fascinating on that other podcast, and I really appreciate you giving us your time.
Yeah, no, happy to come on.
All right. Thank you so much. Have a great day, man.
Yeah, you too.
All right. Good job today, buddy.
I thought that guy's interesting.
Yeah, I'm a fan.
What, you disagree with him?
I loved it. I could have kept talking with him.
All right.
I think he's fascinating. I think he's got a lot of good points. I don't always agree with him, but he's got research and stuff to back him up. So.
He seems smart enough. I'll go with him on it. He's gone to college long enough to teach it at one, Lazo. That's a lot
of learning.
The
thing is, what I was trying to hint to him is that you can interpret those numbers a bunch of different ways.
I know.
Right?
I got your point there, and I think he did too, but I'm just saying I think he seemed like a smart guy. Oh, you know what? We got a show.
Oh, yeah.
When's Toxic and Problematic. I know. Toxic and Problematic has a concert, a concert coming up. That's exciting, right?
Yeah, really. April 5th?
Yes, April 5th at Warehouse on Broadway, the I-70 showdown with Himbri and Post-Sex Nachos. Pretty exciting stuff, huh? The Warehouse on Broadway, that's our new favorite spot. And, of course, love Himbri.
It's our buddy Neil's place. He opened it.
Yeah, we love Himbri and we love Post-Sex Nachos. I think they're going to come in and talk to us, right?
Yeah, at some point they're going to do a podcast with us.
So we'll talk to them soon. But
well, go get tickets. We'll put links to all the stuff we've talked about. That you can go get,
yes,
right?
In the description. And we look forward to that. So we'll talk to them
there
soon.
There you go. Himbri, Post-Sex Nachos, April 5th. That's the first ever Toxic and Problematic Presents. So.
But hopefully not the last.
Attention, ladies in the Leawood area. Beaumont Health and Wellness is here and offers award-winning wellness and beauty treatments like hormone therapy, weight loss, body contouring, microneedling, and injectables. Right now, get our $147 hormone replacement starter kit, including a private consultation, precision blood work, and a free B12 shot to recharge your body. Beaumont Health and Wellness, luxuriously bold, effortlessly sexy, undeniably you. Call 913-261-9855 or book now at BeaumontHealthKS.com.
So, I read in USA Today that the majority of people stop GLP-1 weight loss injection shots in a year. Now, what's concerning is if you get off GLP-1s, there's a real chance you can gain all the weight back. The solution? Alma said, a natural superfood protein shake. University studies show it optimizes your metabolism so you can lose weight easily, and Alma said it's been scientifically proven to preserve muscle mass. Use Alma said with GLP-1s or as a natural alternative. Find out more and see the university studies at almased.com. That's almased.com.
Street Easy asked former New Yorkers if there's anything they miss about life in New York City.
Let me put it this way. House with a home theater sounds appealing. But that's until you realize you no longer have a theater district.
Whether you're looking to rent or it's time to buy, Street Easy has the local expertise you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. Street Easy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
I'm Rhett.
And I'm Link.
And we're the hosts of the podcast Ear Biscuits. We're just two lifelong friends who've been talking about life for a long time.
From being dads to businessmen to all the random things we experience, nothing is off limits.
And now we're talking to you. We're answering your questions, giving advice that you may or may not want to take, and listening to your hilarious stories.
So leave us a voicemail to be part of the show at
1-888-EAR-POD-1 on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.